second that ticks by, lightning strikes at least 100 times somewhere on the surface of the Earth. It's a shocking story, and coming up on Jet Streaming, we'll explore the electrifying aspects of lightning. Welcome to Jet Streaming, the podcast devoted to the celebration of the weather and its ever-changing forms. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with my climatological co-hosts, Craig Edwards and Paul Huttner. Good to see you guys.
Good morning, Kathy.
Morning, Kathy.
Where have you been, young man? Good to see you again.
That's right. I've been hiding under a rock somewhere watching the Doppler radar every day as these storms keep rumbling through the area.
Don't you hate that? That's actually kind of fun.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. But it can get taxing when they come day after day after day.
Well, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Well, but later in the podcast, by the way, we're going to talk about a special giveaway tailored to weather aficionados. But for the bulk of the podcast today, we want to talk about a beautiful yet deadly weather element, and that would be lightning. Lightning kills about 100 people every year in this country. It does millions of dollars in damage. We thought, who better to talk about lightning than Ron Holly? He's a meteorologist with Vaisala Incorporated, based in Tucson, Arizona. He's worked with NOAA Research Labs in Maryland, Florida, Colorado, and Oklahoma, analyzing cloud-to-ground lightning data, and he's developed lightning climatologies over several years. We're glad that Ron got up to join us. How are you doing, by the way?
I'm doing just fine here in Tucson.
Good. Well, of all the things you could do in meteorology here, Ron, you find yourself doing research into lightning. What's the story behind that?
Well, I started my career working in Miami, actually, on thunderstorms. And during the late 1970s, the lightning detection technology came along that detects cloud-to-ground lightning, and it's another way of looking at a thunderstorm. So as things have developed, worked with the lightning data while I was with the NOAA Research Labs, and then I finally came here to Tucson to work for the company that builds the detection systems.
Ron, it's Paul Huttner, and you and I have had the pleasure, the opportunity to visit many times before. I've been down there to the National Lightning Detection Network down in Tucson. Why don't you give our Jetstream listeners a quick overview? How do we detect lightning, and just how accurate it is to pinpoint those cloud-to-ground strikes?
Well, the amazing thing is only around 100 antennas, or we call them sensors, across the country. They're spaced several hundred miles apart, and every time a cloud-to-ground lightning flash hits the surface of the Earth, no matter what it is, it sends out a signal, both electrically and magnetically, that these antennas pick up. And every flash that is seen, that hits the ground, is seen by typically 6 or 7 or 8 antennas, and so each antenna detects the angle and then the time to the nearest microsecond. Those data are sent to the control center here in Tucson, and the position is calculated within about 500 yards and also to the nearest microsecond. So we pick up more than 90% of all the flashes that hit the ground in the U.S.
Ron, when I was working in Indianapolis, Indianapolis Power and Light Company demonstrated to me when I was with the Weather Service, I went down to their facility, and they showed me how accurate. There just happened to be a thunderstorm in the vicinity. We saw the flash, and momentarily it was on their screen. And so the utility companies were very much at the forefront, subscribing to lightning information. The Weather Service was sort of catching up with that. I remember when we were looking at observation systems to upgrade and deploy, the Weather Service did not include lightning information as part of the backbone infrastructure or their observational system, and now I think the Weather Service actually is contracted with lightning services to provide that information. Is that correct, or am I wrong on that?
Yes, you're right. The lightning detection system sort of came in from the side. It was developed here at the University of Arizona and also the University of Florida. The applications are so broad, including the utilities. They were one of the very first customers that, in a sense, it makes sense now to look at how things have developed, because the customer base for the lightning detection network ranges from utilities to forest fire fighting agencies to airport safety and insurance claims, legal claims, and so on, and the government really wouldn't be able to probably handle all that. By the way, the accuracy of the lightning detection network is about 500 yards, 500 meters, and the utilities would like it to be even better, because they'd like to be able to tell exactly which pole was hit. It helps them a lot in their operations.
You know, I heard somewhere, Ron, that lightning can strike even 10 miles away from where a thunderstorm would be. Is that correct?
Yes, if you look at the rain shaft, where the rain is, and either visually or on the radar, there have been some flashes that are definitely coming out the side of the cloud halfway up its height. For whatever reason, we don't know, it comes out sideways, goes out 5 or 10 or I think 15 miles, maybe the ultimate distance, and then makes a right turn and comes straight down the ground in clear air. It's always a thunderstorm there, but it may be some ways away.
Wow.
Ron, we know there's a lot of different kinds of lightning, the cloud-to-cloud, cloud-to-air, in-cloud, and the exotic types as well. We're primarily, of course, concerned with cloud-to-ground lightning here on Earth because that's the dangerous stuff. And I had an interesting experience this week where I coach a Little League baseball team. We're out trying to get our game in, and there's thunder pretty much right overhead. And I was amazed at how many people did not view that as a threat because there wasn't a whole lot of cloud to ground. This storm was just in the developing phase, and I'm out there waving people off saying, you know what, we got to suspend play, and people are looking at me like, you know, you're crazy. We're here at the ballpark and they're sitting on metal bleachers. I see this paper here that you did on recreation deaths and injuries from lightning. How big of a danger is it in some of these outdoor venues, Little League, soccer, to be hit by cloud to ground lightning?
Well, it's a very real situation. The data show that if you look at the last 40 or 50 years, the recreation category has grown a great deal. That includes both group sports like soccer and baseball and so on, as well as getting down to individual things like climbing and hiking and single-person events that didn't really exist 100 years ago. So that is now, that category in general is maybe a third of all the deaths and injuries. So it's a very real one. I looked up some baseball cases since I wrote that paper, and last year in 2006, there was a baseball coach killed in Colorado, and there was a man killed in Louisiana, softball practice, and in 2005, another person killed in Ohio during a softball game, and Massachusetts, 6 adults and 7 teenage softball players went to the hospital, some of them with very serious injuries, so it's a very real thing. It doesn't really matter where you are outside. It's always dangerous. It doesn't matter what's around you. It doesn't matter what you're carrying or holding. Anywhere outside is unsafe, and you simply just need to go inside of a large, substantial building or inside of a metal-top vehicle.
Ron, a couple of weeks ago, we had Rich Neistat on, the science officer from Minneapolis, and he was talking about the possible development of lightning detection for in-cloud and cloud-to-ground or cloud-to-cloud. How is that deployment going to occur? What's the technology out there that's going to enhance the lightning detection program that could maybe help some aviation safety or interests that are beyond cloud-to-ground lightning?
Well, we actually, Vaisala, we have under development and actually in operation from the office here in Tucson. There's two types. One of them is the National Lightning Detection Network has always picked up some cloud flashes, and we pick up maybe 10 or 20% of those. The value of having those is there's a bit of a lead time more often than not that some cloud flashes occur before the first cloud to ground. And so there's some value in that. We've looked at it. It's somewhat helpful, and there are some users that are actually already using it. There's another really much more complicated and incredible system. We have one in Dallas-Fort Worth, a test network that we're running. We see every little channel of the flash in the cloud, and the longest one we have seen so far, single flash with no breaks, lasted less than 2 seconds, was 120 miles long, a continuous flash. And along the 120 miles, it put down a couple of cloud and grounds.
Wow. By the way, when we talk about, I don't know the answer to this question, what's the wattage in a lightning strike?
Well, we actually measure the kiloamps of a flash. With the network, we're running around 20,000 amps for each flash. That's an average. Sometimes they can go up to 700 or 800,000 amps. And one way to look at it, the peak power is about 10,000 megawatts but it only lasts a couple of tenths of a second. So that's one of the reasons why people survive, is even though it's incredibly strong, it's a very short event. 1 to 3 tenths of a second.
Ron, I've been to the detection network there with you. We looked at the strikes, the counts going across the United States on different days. We know that Florida is the lightning capital of the United States. Arizona, Southeast Arizona, New Mexico during the summer monsoon, very high flash rates. How many lightning strikes hit the U.S. every year? And tell us a little bit about how that migrates up through the Midwest as we head through the summer months.
The U.S. In general, year in and year out, we're running about 25 million cloud-to-ground flashes. The maximum definitely is in Florida, and it's the number of flashes per square mile in Florida is over 25 every square mile every year, which is really a lot of lightning. So they have 1.5 million flashes a year, something like that. Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, along the coast of the Gulf, has a large number of flashes, and then it gradually decreases to the north and to the west. I was just looking here at the data for Minnesota. The number of flashes per year that you have is around, on an average, about 400,000 cloud-to-ground flashes. So that's still 400,000 events going on in the state. That's a lot of lightning. Any one of those is perfectly capable of doing damage. There's also places in the west here that Colorado and also Arizona that have fairly high rates at times. We have a short season here in Tucson, but it's a very intense one. We actually rival Florida for about 2 months, but our season's only 2 months long, so we just don't reach the Florida density.
You know, I'm curious, what are the with all the research you've done, what are some of the strangest survival stories that you've run across?
Well, you run into a lot of situations. I think one thing I want to mention is that the fully enclosed metal top vehicle is a safe place. I mean, we all know that a big building like a house or an office or a school is safe as long as you're not in contact with the wiring and the plumbing that may bring the current inside. But a metal top vehicle that's fully enclosed is very safe. I did preparing a paper for a conference coming up here later this summer, and I went through 50 some cases that where people were actually inside cars and trucks and vans when that vehicle was directly struck absolutely on the vehicle by lightning, and no one has ever been killed inside. They're injured, they're not happy, and things happen, and eventually it may occasionally catch fire, but compared to standing outside at a ball field or something like that, it's a very safe place to go.
Okay, Ron, you and I have talked about, kind of continuing on this thread, some of the weird, well, I guess weird incidents where people have been hit, and I know you've talked to some lightning survivor groups. What are some of the injuries long-term that these people have suffered, and what are some of the unusual, if you will, cases of people being struck by lightning?
The typical thing that happens to a person who's been injured by lightning is that it's a neurological event. It goes through the spinal column and gets into the brain, and it really mixes things up. Dr. Marianne Cooper, who's the medical doctor, says it's like a computer hitting your computer being hit by lightning or a power surge. You may turn it on, and it may sort of look okay, but you know it's never going to work right. These people have trouble with walking or remembering things. I mean, we're talking serious deficits that literally make you unemployable, and then people say, oh, you just snap out of it, and they don't. And one of the biggest problems is that lightning injuries often get worse with time, and after about 5 years, people are often a lot worse off than they were at the time when it happened. They sort of struggle through it, but the nerves are just gone. So it's a really debilitating lifetime, long-term thing, and it affects everybody around you at work and at home. So it's something that's not desirable.
What's the most exciting thing in lightning research right now as we speak?
I think the extent of these flashes that we're seeing these long flashes as well as tremendously complicated structure of flashes inside clouds. We're literally rewriting the terminology on what lightning is, and so we've actually divided all the world of lightning into just two parts. It's just cloud-to-ground lightning and cloud flashes, or in-cloud. Anything can happen up in the clouds there. There was an estimate by a group in Germany that had one of these lightning systems detecting all of the lightning in the cloud, and they measured the length of the channels in one sort of typical, pretty good-sized storm. And I think they came up with, converting it from kilometers, 150,000 miles of channels inside the cloud in a one-hour storm.
Wow.
Mm. So that kind of makes us rethink a lot of things, and also looking at what's the value and how can we use that sort of information. There's a lot of potential applications.
By the way, before you go, have you ever seen ball lightning?
Nope.
You guys seen ball? No, you haven't.
Never
Craig, have
seen
you?
It.
I'll tell you what. I've got somebody that keeps hounding me to explain ball lightning, and I went to the website and Googled it, and it says it's a mystery.
That's exactly it.
Is that what you come up with, Ron?
There's two things, three things. One, it's real. Two, nobody knows what it is. And three, if you get a picture, I'll get you $10,000.
All right.
Because there are no credible pictures. There are people that look like they jiggled the camera when there's this. Something going on, but it's not ball lightning.
I told
and the
this.
Chances of a person having a camera at that one-second event every 1,000 people is not very high, so that's why we don't have any pictures of it.
Well, I'm glad you validated that for me, because I kept coming back with it was a mystery, and they didn't like that answer all the time. So I said, well, I'll ask an expert, so thank you for validating.
Every time somebody in plasma physics comes up with something, and I don't know anything about plasma physics, but every time they come up with it, they said, oh, maybe that'll explain ball lightning, and a year later somebody says the same thing with a different theory. So obviously we haven't gotten anywhere at all on it.
Well, we certainly got somewhere with you here today. Thanks so much.
Okay.
That's Ron Holley. He's a lightning expert with Vaisala Incorporated, located in Tucson, Arizona.
Midnight lightning. All around me.
Flashing all around me. You know, it's fun to hear from our listeners. It's really cool to see who writes us notes.
Who writes us notes?
Let me tell you that, by the way, Paul Huttner. We heard from BJ from St. Paul just last week after a conversation with storm chasers and spotters Andy Fisher and Kenny Blumenfeld. BJ is also a certified storm spotter, and he liked last week's show and wanted to pass along this little bit of information. He says, never seek shelter from a tornado under a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Why not, you ask? Wind increases in speed as it's funneled through the bridge. Bridges can and have been toppled by tornadoes. Most bridge designs offer little or no protection for winds in all directions. So what might be a shelter 1 second, he says, is fully exposed for the next 10 seconds.
And, course, you know, a lot of people started thinking that was a safe place after that infamous video in Kansas where the folks are filming the storm, then they pull under the underpass and run up and crawl in there with some other people. They survived, probably luckily.
Right.
But we're learning that's not such a safe place.
It made for some amazing video, though.
That is probably the most compelling and thrilling video that I've ever seen during a storm.
Yeah. And, of course, as BJ points out, don't do it, though.
No.
No, stay away. Thanks, by the way, for letting us know you are listening. We appreciate it. And in celebration and an appreciation for the growing numbers of podcast downloads, we are going to celebrate here at Jet Streaming. Yeah.
Yay.
Cast of thousands here listening in. Our 12th podcast is coming up. Yep, a dozen podcasts in the can. They said it couldn't be done, but yet here we are. We think a dozen podcasts is a thing to celebrate. So what the heck? We're going to give away, what else? A weather radio. Paul, please describe this fine radio.
And here it is, the Storm Tracker Series Weather Alert Radio Flashlight. Automatic alert, signal of all hazard warnings, emergency public broadcast directly from the National Weather Service. This is a nice little radio. It's got the AM, FM band and the weather radio.
And it can recharge your cell phone.
It can.
Yes.
So, good stuff.
I think
Cooks breakfast, too, I think.
Does it call you for dinner?
No, well, we are not going to make this easy to win. You need to correctly answer a difficult weather question. Craig, what is that?
Well, Dr. Seeley provided his question. It says, what is the record for the longest-lived named tropical storm in the North Atlantic? So that's the record for the longest-lived named tropical storm in the North Atlantic.
Okay, so here's the deal. We'll draw one name among the correct guesses during next Tuesday's podcast. So you need to get your responses in between now and June 10th. That's midnight, Sunday, June 10th. We'll draw one name as a winner. Pretty simple stuff. It's fun, too. With any luck, we'll continue to have a dozen more Jet Streaming podcasts. Depends on what management says. Anyway, go to minnesotapublicradio.org, click on Jet Streaming with your guesses, and also you can see the official rules for the contest. Right there.
Well, you don't have the official rules.
Yeah.
Well,
Not just hearsay rules.
No, the official rules. Because of the contest, by the way, we're going to skip the weather website of the week and encourage you to go to minnesotapublicradio.org with your guesses to our weather question. The winner will get the weather radio. One more time, Craig Edwards, the question.
The question is, what is the record for the longest-lived named tropical storm in the North Atlantic. That's a named tropical storm in the North Atlantic.
Excellent. Get those guesses into MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. That's going to do it for Jet Streaming. Paul and Craig, thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thanks, as always.
I appreciate it, and thanks to you for listening. Jet Streaming is produced by Minnesota Public Radio with a ton of help from the incredible Larissa Anderson. I'm Kathy Werzer. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.